Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
It's very exciting because it's 48 years. We're going to be meeting with Bibi Netanyahu, as you know, and the president of Lebanon. And I had a great talk with both of them today. They're going to be having a ceasefire, and that'll include Hezbollah.
A 10-day ceasefire has begun in Lebanon, raising hopes throughout the country. But southern Lebanon remains occupied by Israeli troops. That's about 10% of the country. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then we look at the prospect of another round of peace talks between the United States and Iran after the first round collapsed. And we speak to Alia Rahman. She's filed a personal injury claim against the Department of Homeland Security after ICE agents in Minneapolis smashed her car window, dragged her out, and detained her while she was heading to a medical appointment.
I was carried face down through the street by my cuffed arms and legs while yelling that I had a brain injury and was disabled. I now cannot lift my arms normally. I was never asked for ID, never told I was under arrest, never read my rights, and never charged with a crime.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Celebrations broke out across Lebanon overnight after Israel agreed to a 10-day ceasefire following U.S. broker talks to end 7 weeks of attacks that have killed nearly 2,200 people in Lebanon, including 172 children. Israel continued airstrikes right up until the ceasefire took effect Thursday evening, including attacks on the city of Tyre that killed at least 13 people. Elsewhere, Israel bombed a school in southern Lebanon and blew up the last bridge over the Latani River, further isolating southern Lebanon from the rest of the country. Israeli forces now occupy about 10% of Lebanon's territory, with an estimated 1.2 million people displaced from their homes. This is Ibrahim Sawaidi, a 30-year-old living in a tent in Beirut after he fled Israeli strikes in the suburb of Dahiya.
They gave a 10-day ceasefire, but we don't accept that. 10 days, if we want to go back to our homes, 10 days and the war returns, we don't want that. Either our land is fully returned or we don't want the ceasefire. We'll continue with the war. My home in Dahiya, in Beirut's southern suburbs, has been destroyed. Who will compensate me?
After headlines, we'll go to Beirut for the latest. In Israel, hundreds of people rallied in Tel Aviv Thursday to denounce escalating attacks on Palestinians by Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank. Human rights groups say it was the largest protest of its kind yet in Israel. It came after Israel's High Court lifted a weeks-long wartime ban on public gatherings. The U.S. House of Representatives rejected a war powers resolution seeking to rein in President Trump's ability to wage war on Iran. On Thursday, every House Republican voted against the resolution except for Kentucky Congressmember Thomas Massie. It failed on a vote of 213 to 214 after Democrat Jared Golden of Maine crossed the aisle to vote with the Republicans. The Senate narrowly rejected an Iran war powers resolution one day earlier. On Thursday, President Trump repeated his claim that a deal to end the war in Iran is, quote, very close, and that direct talks with Iran could resume in Pakistan as soon as this weekend. Despite the claims, the Pentagon is surging thousands of additional troops to the Middle East, including an additional 6,000 sailors and aviators joining the USS George H.W. Bush aircraft carrier battle group. The ships were recently spotted steaming around the southern tip of Africa, avoiding a much shorter passage through the Red Sea, where they would be in range of missiles and drones of Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi movement. In Ukraine, at least 17 people were killed as Russia launched its deadliest drone and missile attacks of the year on Kyiv and other cities. Among the dead was a 12-year-old child. Dozens more were wounded. This is Valery Shashkov, an 84-year-old who had to have glass shards removed from his face after Russian strikes shattered the windows of his home.
It hit me like a smash. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't figure out what had happened. That blood was flowing all around me, you see. I looked up, and then there was another strike.
The violence came at the end of a 32-hour Orthodox Easter truce that each side accused the other of violating. On Thursday, Russian officials said a Ukrainian drone attack on the Black Sea port of Tuapse killed two people, including a teenage girl. The strikes also triggered a massive fire at one of Russia's largest oil refineries. In New Jersey, progressive Democrat Ana Lilia Mejia has won a special election to fill the House seat left vacant by New Jersey Governor Mikey Sherrill. Mejia's victory further narrows Republicans' razor-thin majority. When she's sworn in, House Speaker Mike Johnson will only be able to afford a defection by a single Republican in order to pass legislation on a party-line vote. Mejia is the daughter of a Colombian garment worker and a Dominican laborer and a former union organizer who served as a national political director for Bernie Sanders in 2020. On the campaign trail, she called for the abolition of ICE and was the only candidate to say she believed Israel committed genocide in Gaza.
80% of Gaza is in rubble. Can we agree that that is wrong? Can we agree that cutting the electricity to water desalinization plants is not only wrong, but it goes against the Geneva Convention and it is a war crime?
The House of Representatives has approved a short-term extension of FISA, that's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, over the objections of privacy advocates who warn it allows the government to conduct warrantless domestic surveillance on a massive scale. Without congressional action, the program was due to expire in 3 days. The White House and House Speaker Mike Johnson were seeking an 18-month extension, but those plans were thwarted when a block of conservatives revolted against the bill. It also faces opposition from some Democrats, including California Congressmember Ro Khanna, who said in a social media post Republicans called lawmakers back at midnight for a, quote, secret vote to reauthorize FISA while America sleeps.
This would give Donald Trump the power to surveil or collect data on Americans through a backdoor. There really is not a philosophical debate here. A yes vote is a vote to give Donald Trump more power over American citizens. A no vote is a vote to stand up to Donald Trump. Every Democrat should be a no on the reauthorization of FISA.
The House of Representatives has passed a resolution to extend temporary protected status, that's TPS, for 330,000 Haitian immigrants in the United States after the Trump administration canceled the program. 10 Republicans joined House Democrats in Thursday's 224-204 vote. The bill was sponsored by Massachusetts Democrat Ayanna Pressley. Ahead of Thursday's vote, she told the story of Rebecca, a Haitian immigrant who moved to Massachusetts after the devastating earthquake in 2010 resulted in the deaths of an estimated 220,000 people in what was already the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
She witnessed the rise in gangs. and saw her beautiful country overtaken by political violence and instability. After surviving multiple kidnapping attempts, out of desperation, Rebecca made the same decision that any of us would make in her position. She immigrated to the United States. She quickly enrolled in school to learn English. She obtained a job to support herself and her family. Now in 2026, thanks to her legal status under TPS, Rebecca is a certified nursing assistant.
A Senate version of the bill extending TPS for Haitians faces an uphill battle in the Senate, and the White House has promised to veto any such legislation. President Trump's repeatedly used racist rhetoric to lash out against Haitians. During the 2024 campaign, he amplified the unfounded lie that Haitians were eating pets, cats and dogs, in Springfield, Ohio. The acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, has announced his resignation from the agency just 1 year after his appointment to oversee Trump's rapid expansion of nationwide ICE raids, immigration, detention, and deportations. Todd Lyons, who was never confirmed by the Senate, says he's stepping down in May. During his tenure, he repeatedly defended ICE's tactics as the agency faced mounting scrutiny over its agents' violent crackdown on protesters and dehumanizing treatment of immigrants. In Minnesota, Hennepin County prosecutors have charged an ICE agent with felony assault for allegedly pointing his gun at the heads of two people who were in a car beside him. Earlier this year, the agent, Gregory Donald Morgan Jr., reportedly had tried to pass their vehicle while illegally driving his unmarked SUV on a Minneapolis highway. Hennepin County Attorney Mary Moriarty announced the charges on Thursday.
Mr. Morgan's conduct was extremely dangerous. Driving while pointing a weapon out of your moving vehicle at the victims who were in another moving vehicle could have led to yet another disastrous incident in a community that has already suffered too many.
This is the first criminal case against an ICE agent involved in Trump's so-called Operation Metro Surge in Minnesota. During the crackdown earlier this year, federal agents deployed to the Twin Cities shot and killed two U.S. citizens, Renee Good and Alex Preti. In related news, Minneapolis resident Alia Rahman has filed a personal injury claim against DHS after ICE agents in Minneapolis smashed her car window, dragged her out, and detained her while she was heading to a doctor's appointment in January. Alia Rahman will join us from Minneapolis later in the broadcast. Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott has threatened to cut about $200 million in public safety funding to Houston, Dallas, and Austin if their local law enforcement agencies refuse to collaborate with ICE in the arrest and detention of immigrants over minor infractions such as traffic stops. This week, Abbott's office reportedly notified Houston officials the state would be withdrawing some $110 million in public safety grants after the city adopted an ordinance that limits police's cooperation with ICE. The FBI has arrested a man who was shot by ICE agents in Patterson, California last week and charged him with assaulting a federal officer. Carlos Ivan Mendoza Hernandez was taken into custody after being discharged from the hospital Monday, where he underwent several surgeries from multiple gunshot wounds, including to the jaw. Hernandez reportedly attempted to drive away when federal officers surrounded his car during a traffic stop while he was on his way to work. He later said he feared the officers were going to shoot him. Meanwhile, in Texas, advocates are demanding the release of a longtime court interpreter and the only licensed Punjabi, Hindi, and Urdu interpreter in the state who was detained by ICE last month. Meenu Batra has lived in the United States for over 35 years. She fled India following pogroms against Sikhs in Punjab and arrived in the United States in 1991. Her attorneys fear Batra could be deported to a country she has no ties to under Trump's so-called third country agreements. Batra has spoken out against the inhumane conditions of her detention at the El Valle ICE jail in Raymondville, Texas. In Virginia, police say former Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax fatally shot his estranged wife, Serena Fairfax, before taking his own life. The couple's teenage children were home at the time of the murder-suicide, which took place 2 weeks before Fairfax faced a court-ordered deadline to move out of their home. In 2019, two women publicly accused Fairfax of sexual assault. And Hampshire College, a private liberal arts college in Amherst, Massachusetts, has announced it will close by the end of 2026 following years of financial struggles. The Huron Consulting Group has warned over 400 of the nation's 1,700 private, nonprofit, four-year colleges and universities are at risk of closing or having to merge within the next 10 years. This comes amidst growing attacks on education by the Trump administration and decades of skyrocketing tuition costs, declining student enrollment, and a student debt crisis. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Coming up, we go to Beirut, Lebanon, and also look at a possible new round of talks between the United States and Iran. Stay with us. Times of Love by Las Cafeteras here, actually in our Democracy Now! Studio in New York in 2017. I'm where they usually are, and that is in Los Angeles. Yes, Democracy Now! Is in Los Angeles because the new documentary has had its theatrical release in New York and now Los Angeles and the Bay Area called Steal This Story, Please. Today, I'll be at the Lemley Royal at 110 to do a Q&A after the film premieres. It's a fundraiser for the Pacifica radio station KPFK here in Los Angeles. As the film travels the country, Democracy Now! Is helping with fundraisers for public media throughout the United States. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin looking at the latest on Iran. The stakes could not be higher, as the fragile ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran has not yet led to the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, the economically vital waterway for economies all over the world. On Thursday, President Trump repeated his claim a deal to end the war in Iran is very close and that direct talks with Iran could resume in Islamabad, Pakistan as soon as this weekend. This comes after a high-level Pakistani delegation visited Tehran on Wednesday, seeking to lay the groundwork for more negotiations. A spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry said he remains skeptical of the United States.
It remains to be seen to what extent the other side is truly serious about the claims they've made regarding diplomacy. It is the Americans who must prove their seriousness, because they have not only failed to adhere to their commitments many times, but have also fundamentally destroyed the negotiating table.
The Pentagon, meanwhile, is surging thousands of additional troops to the Middle East, including an additional 6,000 sailors and aviators joining the USS George H.W. Bush Aircraft Carrier Battle Group. During a news briefing at the Pentagon Thursday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth directed some of his comments to the Iranians.
We are reloading with more power than ever before and better intelligence. Even more importantly, better intelligence than ever before, as you expose yourself with your movement to our watchful eye. We are locked and loaded on your critical dual-use infrastructure, on your remaining power generation, and on your energy industry. We'd rather not have to do it, but we're ready to go at the command of our president and at the push of a button.
For more on the latest developments in a very pivotal moment for this war, we're joined by Ali Vaez. He's in Geneva, in Switzerland, senior advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group, where he's also the Iran Project Director. He wrote a piece earlier this month for The New York Times headlined, "Trump Has Lost Control of Events in Iran." Ali Vaez, thanks for joining us again. Do you feel that way still? What is your understanding of talks again happening in Pakistan, the significance of the Pakistani delegation going to Tehran?
It's great to see you. Yes, I do believe that the reason the president wanted an off-ramp was because he did realize that he had lost control of this war. That he went in with unrealistic expectations that this would be easy and in a matter of a few days, the Iranians would fold and would capitulate to his terms. 5 weeks later, he's nowhere closer to Iranian capitulation than was the case at the beginning of this war. And in fact, now the Iranians even have more leverage in the form of their control over the Strait of Hormuz. My understanding is that the talks in Islamabad didn't really go that well because neither side was willing to make the necessary concessions that are required to reach a compromise because they both believe that they still have the upper hand. And the Pakistani mediators are now trying to negotiate some sort of a framework, a memorandum of understanding that would at least outline what are the key areas that they would have to negotiate. So with that, they would be able to extend the ceasefire. That's the objective, which at this point remains a very moderate ambition, I would say.
So can you respond to Pete Hegseth saying the U.S. is locked and loaded and this back and forth between the president of the United States, President Trump, and the Pope, Pope Leo, who's on a trip through Africa, who first said, you know, blessed be the peacemakers, and then said the world is being ravaged by a handful of tyrants. Yet it's held together by a multitude of supportive brothers and sisters.
Well, first of all, it's—I don't know what the president expects the Pope to say, other than talking about peace and not being a warmonger. I mean, it's really stunning to expect the Pope to say anything other than that. Look, the reality is, yes, the U.S. might be locked and loaded, and the U.S. is sending more troops to the region, and the Iranians are paying attention to what the U.S. does and not what it says. So no doubt that we might be at some point returning to a hot war. But the same applies to the Iranians, that they too are locked and loaded, and they too have demonstrated that they have preserved a degree of retaliatory capacity that would be pretty problematic for the United States. And they still have cards to play. They can still, in addition to the Strait of Hormuz, shut down, Bab el-Mandab, the access to the Red Sea, where Saudi Emirati oil is being exported to Asia. And that would create a major economic shock for the world and for the United States as well. So, yes, both sides still have cards to play. Both sides can still inflict pain on one another. But at the end of the day, they will have to go to the negotiating table and compromise. So why not do it now?
So let's talk about the nuclear program. Hegseth said the War Department will ensure Iran never has a nuclear weapon, never. Khamenei, who was assassinated in this joint U.S.-Israeli airstrike at the start of the war, had issued a fatwa forbidding nuclear weapons under Islamic law. However, Iranian officials have openly acknowledged their capacity to build such weapons if they choose. Can you respond to what the back and forth is right now with President Trump said they are agreeing with the United States? What exactly do you think Iran is agreeing to, and how far will these negotiations, the next round after the first collapse, go?
Look, the Iranians have been saying for years that they don't want nuclear weapons. The former supreme leader had a religious edict, a fatwa against nuclear weapons, in the opening pages of the 2015 nuclear deal. The Iranians committed to not developing a nuclear weapon. So that is not a new thing, then that's not a new concession to President Trump. The question has always been, would the Iranians accept to curb their nuclear activities for a long period of time and subject them to international monitoring? And in return, would the U.S. be willing to provide them with economic incentives and sanctions relief? We had a deal along those lines. The president withdrew from it and now has difficulty getting back into a deal that does the same thing. You know, we're now talking about the administration asking for restrictions on Iran's enrichment program for 20 years. The most important restrictions in the 2015 nuclear deal were for 15 years. So did we go through all of this maximum pressure that really devastated the Iranian middle class, and now two rounds of war in less than a year, costing the United States hundreds of billions of dollars to add just an additional 5 years on restrictions on Iran's nuclear program? It really doesn't make any sense. But again, at the end of the day, if the United States wants Iran to have a peaceful nuclear program, the best solution is a negotiated agreement which would reestablish international monitoring over that program and would basically impose certain restrictions on it. Not completely shut it down, because that would be a humiliating outcome for the Iranians. And you know, Amy, unfair deals beget unfaithful deal makers. And you definitely don't want that with a country that has already learned how to enrich uranium and has what it takes to develop nuclear weapons if the political will is there.
Ali Vaez, in a moment, we're going to go to Beirut. But I wanted to ask you how the 10-day Israel-Lebanon ceasefire will impact the second round of negotiations between Iran and the United States.
Well, that was a necessary condition for the talks to move forward, but it is not sufficient. As I said, it would require the United States to step aside from maximalist demands. It would require the Iranians to also show flexibility in order to reach at least a framework agreement. But without a ceasefire in Lebanon, that would not have been possible. So this is a good development, but it's not enough to reach a deal.
And the significance of the House and the Senate not passing a war powers resolution around Iran as we wrap up?
Well, that clearly demonstrates that this presidency is completely unchecked, and the president can wage wars that are illegal, not just according to international law, but even according to U.S. Constitution, because it doesn't have the consent of Congress. And it's really a pity that Congress cannot assert its authority in a case where American lives are at stake, in addition to the economic costs for American taxpayers.
Ali Baez, I want to thank you very much for being with us, senior advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group, where he's also the Iran